Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
I can't record with you today.
Oh, why not?
Well, I'm furloughed. I can't do anything.
You're not furloughed from the show.
Oh, sure I am. I'm not getting paid for this. So this show's a lot like my government job. I'm not getting paid, although I have to show up and do the work. I don't want to do either.
Now, does the government job buy you meals?
You know what? Instead of me working, I figured I would get a guest commentator.
Oh, okay.
All the way from the Windy City. Advance to the microphone and identify yourself.
This is Angel Medina talking to you from the Windy City, although we're not so much windy as we are bitterly cold right now.
Oh, are you guys going to get the snow that's going to be pummeling us tomorrow?
No. I heard about the snow that you guys were getting about 4 days ago that was forecasted to come by our area, but now it hasn't been canceled, but we will. It's going to come. Actually, I let me rephrase that. We are going to get the edge of it, but it's going to come more in the rain, or more in the form of rain than
this. See, this is actually the first real snowfall we're going to have. We had a couple inches here and there, but they're talking, 4 inches maybe? Again, depending on where you are. But I have nothing on the ground where I live. All the storms that have gone south or north in the Twin Cities proper, I got nothing.
Oh, well, we've got 6 inches over here. We got it like 3 days ago.
Yeah, you guys are greedy.
Yeah. That's why we're giving it to you now for tomorrow.
So. Yeah. Now, let me ask one quick question before we get into what's got us going today. Do you guys feel old that Neil Gaiman's Sandman started 30 years ago?
The thing about the internet is that you see people posting comments like that all the time about this and that. If you remember this, you're old, or they'll put something like this is so and so with certain amount of years old. Do you feel old yet right now? So, I sort of desensitized myself to that. Just the idea, I'm going to be 55 in about 2 months from now.
We're not far behind. I'm at 53. And, yeah. I got that too when I used to read Comic Buyer's Guide because Maggie used to put in there, 1 year ago today, 5 years ago. And that's when I started realizing how long I've been reading comics, when she started listing like early comics. This was published X number of years ago. And you're like, oh, it's like it was just like yesterday to me,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, for me, is I listen to the same radio station only on the weekends that I used to listen to in high school. And the thing is on early Sunday afternoon, they play the oldie stuff, which I was like, I don't want to hear this oldie stuff. I want to hear my music and stuff. And yet now I'm at that point in my life when early afternoons on Sunday, they play the oldie stuff. It's my music. And I'm thinking like, oh, this is oldie stuff.
Like 1985 song, when did Motley Crue become classic rock?
Yeah.
Well, we're not here to talk about how old we are. We're here to talk about how old somebody else is.
And he's not that much older. That's the funny thing. He's only about barely, I think maybe 10 or 11 years older than I am.
Yeah. He was born in 54.
But ladies and gentlemen, over the weekend, George Perez announced that he is retiring. He will.
And Corey, oddly enough, got up and go, woohoo, podcast topic. So he didn't have to think of one.
But I also want to point out that, first off, he's 65, which is when most people retire. And second, how odd it is that a comic artist or a comic creator of any kind gets to announce their retirement. Because most of them are like, I can't get a gig. Or they pass away.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare that a comic creator says, I'm retiring.
Yeah.
Well, but his wasn't by age. I mean, he's been having problems with his eyes. And I don't know if that's been a decision in his retiring. But either way, he's had a hell of a run. I mean, his first... No, go ahead.
You know, I was going to say before you get off of that is that also I know he's had plenty of trouble with his wrist too, but then he's also that thing, not the years, it's the mileage type thing, because he probably puts in more drawing than just about any other artist that I know. I mean, if you go to any conventions, you'll see the guy's a madman drawing machine. He never stops drawing, like, ever. And so I think that's the other thing about with his whole retiring thing is just that when you talk about his eyes, it's just the fact that the guy just draws so nonstop. You know, I imagine him as a guy who gets up the minute he gets up, he's drawing, and as soon as he goes to bed, he's drawing. And plus, later on, I'm going to tell a story that exemplifies just how much of a drawing machine.
What I was gonna say, I mean, his first professional involvement, and this is courtesy of Wikipedia, although we could make it an Ask the Strode. Let me get my shiny dime out. For a shiny new dime, Corey, what was George Perez's first professional debut?
Now, is this credited or uncredited?
I'm not even sure, because it's listed in the wikis, but they didn't say if it was credited or uncredited.
Because he started as Rich Buckler's assistant. And I think the first credit he got was in an early Deathlock story. But he was doing backgrounds and work for Rich Buckler long before he got credit.
I'll give you half a point. I'll give you a nickel for that. Because it was Astonishing Tales number 25. And it was a Deathlock.
That's the first Deathlock story.
Yeah. So if you got that, hang on to it. Look what happened with Stan Lee's first story / last done, whatever, went up in price. Maybe this one will do the same.
So, and there's a story about his real early career that I've always found fascinating. He was working as Rich Buckler's assistant. He wanted a regular gig. And at the time, Marv Wolfman was the editor-in-chief at Marvel. You know, that was during the revolving door era, where if you came in and you worked for more than 2 months, you became editor-in-chief. But on the black and white books, he was doing White Tiger. And, you know, Perez asked to do regular, you know, the color comics. And Wolfman said, you're not good enough. You don't understand perspective. You really, you know, I look at your stuff and, you know, you're not, that's your big flaw. So he actually went back and worked on it. And the next time he came into the offices, he brought in a splash page for White Tiger. And I don't know which issue of Deadly Hands of Kung Fu it is, but it's one of those. And it's from way up in the sky, and the tops of the buildings spell out the White Tiger. And he has White Tiger over top of it. And he says, am I any better? And Wolfman says, oh, yeah, you're a lot better. So he was a guy who real early on, if you gave him a criticism, he would take it to heart and try to improve immediately. And by 1976, he was working on The Avengers, The Fantastic Four, and The Inhumans.
I don't, isn't that ridiculous?
Go ahead, Angel.
As someone who's worked in the industry and I hear that, that's just ridiculous to me. Because I'm just thinking, like, someone who works in this industry, one of the things we talk about a lot, artists, now is the inhuman pace that we're expected to draw, you know, because drawing 22 pages a month is a lot of work. And yet you had people like Perez back in the 70s who was drawing not just three issues, but three group issues, you know. And when I got into this business, I always felt like a failure, because I thought that was supposed to be my output. And I remember at the beginning of my career just struggling so much to try to get that output of putting out, you know, one issue a month, thinking like, oh, I'm a failure, because look, George Perez was able to do three books at a time. And I remember as a kid being excited that he was drawing so much, you know.
Do you remember what your first Perez book was that you read?
Oh, yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, that was going to lead into one of the stories I was going to say, because I actually have the issue right here in front of me. I pulled it out, and it's the actual issue I had when I was a kid, and it was Avengers 148.
Oh,
and
wow.
The reason I'll always remember that is because I was at that age, I was in the fourth grade, and I was reaching that age where I had been reading comics since like I was in kindergarten, you know. Actually, I was looking at comics even before. I used to look at comics before I could read them. And the reason I got into drawing comics is that after a while I got frustrated because I didn't know what was going on, so I decided to draw my own. That's the risk. But by the first time I was in the fourth grade, that was at that age where I was finally starting to notice the names of the creators, because before that, you're just a kid. You just cared about the story, you know. You didn't really pay attention to, like, that someone was actually out there creating this stuff. And the very first name that I noticed was George Perez. And I'll always remember being on that. I was on a public bus. I had just traded someone for this Avengers 148, where he fought the Squadron Supreme. And I remember when I opened it up to that splash page, and I couldn't believe how beautiful the artwork was there. So I had to look to see who the name of the guy was. And that's when I first noticed George Perez. He was the very first creator that I ever noticed in my life.
For me, it was kind of inadvertent because, again, you know, I'm reading as a 12-year-old and not really paying attention to stuff. But I started reading Justice League of America, I think, whenever Zatanna showed up in her dominatrix outfit. You know, she wasn't wearing the fishnets. And Perez did the run, which was also my first exposure to Darkseid, which is why I always thought Darkseid was such a wimp. It was that the JLA, JSA crossover where they went into the New Gods, I think 184 to 185, and Darkseid was defeated by a little hand of trick by Firestorm, you know, and I'm like, really? That's Darkseid? What a wimp. Why was I an idiot? And then he did the Shaggy Man story in 186. He disappeared and then showed up 192 to 200. So I had no idea who he was. He wasn't really on the radar, but almost subliminally, it was like you noticed, oh, wow, the art, like you said, it's just so much better in these issues versus the ones in between or the ones before. But it wasn't to the point, and when we eventually get into our faves, you know, where I actually, to the point where when I see Perez on a project, I'm like, yeah, just, I'm ordering it. It's not even a question of what is it. I'm just ordering it. How about you, Mr. Strode?
Avengers 141. I had a babysitter whose sister, her husband, would read comics and throw them away. And they said, well, why not just give them to Corey? He loves comic books. So they gave me a big stack, and in that was Avengers 141. And I was, you know, blown away by the art. And I was like, oh, I got to get more of this. I got to get more Avengers. And when I picked up another Avengers book, it was drawn by Don Heck. And now I appreciate Don Heck, but at the time, going from George Perez to Don Heck, inked by Vince Coletta.
Yeah.
Oh!
Yeah, that's not a good act to follow. I remember a Hembeck cartoon where he was talking about how Jack of Hearts was being interviewed by Hembeck and talking about how, you know, he was created by George Perez, drew him, and everybody, you know, didn't like drawing Jack of Hearts because of the detail that Prez put into it. And consequently, anybody who drew the character later asked for more money because of the detail in the character. And then eventually they did a miniseries where they changed it all together. Well, while Jack is busy talking about this, Hembeck looks at his costume and kind of motions to the artist to raise the frame. So eventually it just disappears. So you just see the top of their heads. And then Jack knows it. What's going on here? Oh, nothing. We just thought we'd give more room for your dialogue. Oh yeah. Well, I got more room for this. Bam, poof, poof. And then he lowers back down and there's Hembeck all beat to hell. But that was essentially it. I mean, and Corey and I have talked about it in our fantasy booking. Almost any group we came up with, Church Friends, in our fantasy booking, he's a god. He's doing every single group book that we came up with. You know, you thought he was fast in reality, Angel. Oh no, he was doing like 5-10 books the way we were booking him.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Well, and look at the costumes he created over at DC Nightwing. No one wanted to draw that original Nightwing costume he created. And I still think the reason Troia just got kind of boofed out of existence was because nobody wanted to draw the Perez Troia costume.
Yeah, he was like a guy that he was not like most other pencilers. That he seemed to really thrive on just putting as much detail in it. I remember whenever he would draw like some kind of mechanical headquarters and the amount of, you know, machinery and all that, and the gizmos in the background was just, I'd be just blown away thinking like, holy crap, you know. And I remember when I tried emulating that kid at school, he looked at all the detail and I said, and that kid was making fun of my detail, saying like, why would a wall have all those buttons on it, you know, and it never even occurred to me. I just thought, it looks cool because Perez, that's what Perez does.
And whenever Perez would draw rubble or an explosion or something, he always had like twice as much rubble as there would normally be.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it just made it more dramatic.
Yeah.
But I still, when you look at those early issues, I mean, he got much better as he went along. But even those early issues, he was great early on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've always loved about him is all of his characters had different faces. Captain America's face was different from Hawkeye's face, was different from Thor's face. Whereas, you know, I'm just going to use John Byrne. John Byrne, Marvel used to make fun of the fact that all of his blonde characters have the exact same face.
Oh, yeah. Buscema was guilty of that, too. John Buscema. I remember picking up some early Buscema issues when they were being reprinted through the Marvel Super Action. And even though John Buscema was, you know, much better in terms of being a knowledgeable as far as like anatomy and all that stuff than Perez, I do remember there was one panel where they showed Hawkeye, Captain America, and Henry Pym, all in a lab talking to each other, and they all had their masks pulled down so they could all see each other's face. And Hawkeye and Henry Pym and Captain America all had blonde hair. They look like triplets.
Yeah.
They look exactly like the same guy.
Sorry, I was saying before, not me. I love the way George Perez drawed women. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Man. You know, it didn't make the list, but I mean, when he did that Saxon Violins with
Peter David.
Yeah. Yeah. That was just like a fanboy's dream, you know? Oh.
Well, you know, speaking of the way he drew women, there is this guy, I'll never forget him, a guy named Bill Little. And Bill Little, he used to be like my main competitor throughout my junior year and my high school year as far as like artist-wise. We were always trying to outdraw each other. But I remember like about 2 years after I graduated high school, at that time I was working at Sears. And I remember I used to take the bus to Sears because I was at a mall. And so as I was in the back of the bus, Bill Little gets on the bus and he sees me there. We hadn't seen each other since we graduated. So he sits down and we start talking. And then he goes to me like on the bus ride, he goes, hey, did you hear about that? Did you see that new movie by Prince called Purple Rain that just came out? And I go, no. But I heard good things. He goes, oh, man, you got to see this movie, Purple Rain. It's really, really cool. And the movie's great. But the best part about it is that there's this girl on there. Her name's Apollonia. And Angel, the body on her is absolute perfection. I mean, if you look at her boobs are so perfect. It's almost as if George Perez female came to life. And I always remember that thing. You're like, holy cow, this woman has got to be hot. And when I saw the woman, and I remember there's a scene where Prince is making out with her, I thought, yeah, that's right. That's a George Perez body right there.
Well, and the other thing about Perez is he drew women's bodies differently based on, well, he drew everybody's bodies different. Captain America's body was different from Superman. Superman had the bodybuilder pose. Captain America was built like an acrobat. Flash was, you know, drawn like he was a, you know, long distance runner. He was always really good about that. And when I read Avengers JLA, he kept those faces and body types that he'd used back in the 70s and 80s and 90s in Avengers JLA. It was yeah, uncanny. Yeah, we all talk about how Alex Ross uses models and everything. I don't think Perez used models. I think he just had these characters in his head.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's... And the fact that he always, I don't know if he asked to be on team books, but he always seemed to be on a team book. And well,
I don't know if he asked to be on there, but one, it looked like he had fun doing it no matter what. But the one thing I did learn real early in my career when I first started drawing professionally is that you get pigeonholed real fast.
Yeah.
So one of the things I always used to recommend a young artist is when I always said, listen, when you show your portfolio, make sure you show a portfolio of the type of characters you want to draw. Because if you go up to an editor and show them stuff that you think they want to see, you're going to get pigeonholed real fast whether you want to draw this or not. And that's the one thing I learned is that you get pigeonholed really fast. And I wonder if that might also have been a factor in why Perez was doing those team books. But then also it could be that he's probably the only guy who was able to draw so many characters, you know, and do three books at the same time. Where I remember reading interviews from other people and they said, oh, I don't want to draw a team book. I have to draw 12 issues and put it out, you know, 100 pages in 1 month.
Well, I think that probably even before Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is an accomplishment in and of itself, he had enough clout that he could draw, you know, he could work anywhere he wanted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think that no matter what, he's one of the few guys who could go into any comic book company and say, I want to do that. And they would figure out a way to get him to let him do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So let's, I thought first, Angel, you've been hinting that you have some George Perez stories. I have not met him. Joe, have you met George Perez?
No. One of the rare creators who I absolutely adore that I've never had a chance to visit or see in person.
So it looks like Angel's got a one-up on us.
Yeah, actually, see, I thought you guys knew that about it. I've been friends with Perez for years. I got introduced to him by Rob Liefeld way before we ever broke into the business because Liefeld was a huge Perez fan that he was like a Perez groupie. He would follow him to different conventions. And then I remember when Rob came up here to Chicago, he said, yeah, I'll introduce you to George Perez. And that was the first time I had met him. This was, I would say, like 1984, 85, something like that. And I've known George Perez since then. As a matter of fact, I do got a story. I'm going to wait to see if you tell your story first. But I'm going to tell you my story. It's going to be one of the greatest moments of my life. But it has to do with the fact that of my relationship with George.
I don't have any George Perez stories.
Oh, I thought you were about
to... No, we neither Joe nor I have met him because he has not come to any of the conventions up here because he's probably smart and just goes to the ones where it's warm and the women wear skimpy clothing. Because every picture I see is either him drawing or him surrounded by women in very skimpy clothing. And I just look at those pictures and go, there's a man who's the happiest man in comics.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, when he announced his retirement, one of the things he said is that because of his physical limitations now, the only two conventions he will continually do from now on are the two that are closest to his heart, which is Dragon Con and Fetish Con. And he's there. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen him on. Before he signed off of Facebook, I was friends with him, and he posts pictures of him at Fetish Con. And here you see him, this smiley, you know, old geek guy, and he's surrounded by women wearing, how should I put it, clothes there that are barely there.
Yeah. And I think his wife is a belly dancer, or used to be a belly dancer, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something that he's very proud of, as a matter of fact.
Well, that was why he had the character in Sax and Violence was
right,
a belly
right.
dancer. But, we just had you on because we thought that you were a fan. We didn't know that you were in the know.
Oh, yeah, it's funny. I thought you guys knew that. I've known for years. And, you know, let me get my story out of the way, then. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, then. This is I've had a lot. In my career, I've had some really great moments. And now, this isn't the greatest moment. The greatest moment, I will save it for, like, another podcast or something like that. But this has got to be in the top five of greatest moments in my career.
Well, the greatest moment, now, of course, is when you met Joe and I.
Oh, yeah. That ranks number one. And the fact that I met you guys at the same time, that's the part that killed me.
Well, we, that way Corey and I couldn't argue all eternity who you liked better.
Oh, I know you like Joe better.
Well, to be honest with you, that when I first met you guys, the thing that got me was that you guys were the very first two people who I could speak to about Gerber's work. That's the thing that hit me when I first met you two guys. So I could never, every time I mentioned Gerber, either people didn't know who he was, or be like, oh, he wrote those really weird stories. You know?
So here we go. Angel's All right. George Perez story.
All right.
Okay, so about 10 years ago, I get invited to this show up in Spain. Well, actually, you know what? Let me, I'm jumping ahead of time. Let me prelude that back to the, let's remember that the very first artist I noticed was George Perez. I was on that public bus, and I remember opening up issue 148 of The Avengers and seeing this splash page, which I don't know if you guys remember it, but the splash is, shows like, where, since they had the Squadron Supreme, who were a knockoff, obviously, of the Justice League, George Perez decided to do a homage to the Justice League, and that in the splash page, he's got on one side of the page a bunch of headshots showing all the Squadron Supreme members, and on the other side, he's got headshots of all the Avengers, which is something that DC used to do for a while. Man, I didn't know that at the time, but I just thought it looked cool as that. And I remember I was so astounded by this comic, thinking like, wow, this has got to be seriously the greatest comic book ever, just because the way the artwork was, the story, even the inking. Romeo Tango is the inker who, by sheer coincidence, turned out to be the very first professional inker that ever inked my stuff, not a regular series. So getting back to Perez, so now I've become this huge George Perez fanatic, to the point where when I met one of my best friends, his name was Shia, he was a hardcore DC guy, I was a hardcore Marvel guy, so we would always have the Marvel DC debate. And so when it came to artists, I always just said, no matter what artist you name to me, no one can beat George Perez, because every single panel George Perez does is perfect. That was always my argument. You know? And then George Perez was also this guy who inspired, the very first artist who inspired me. Before that, I was always drawing, but, you know, I was like a kid just randomly drawing. Perez was the first guy I actually tried to emulate, especially the effects. I love the way he did all the, you know, like zapping effects, explosion effects, the rubble, all that stuff. He was the very first guy I copied that. I, you know, if we were in front of each other physically right now, I would actually show you some things I still do to this day that's me ripping off George Perez. So now I've hammered in just how much of an inspiration was. He was the very first inspiration on my artwork. There's five guys who inspired me more than anyone else, and he's in that top five. The second guy who inspired me, I would say, was in junior high. My friend I told you about, the DC guy, he introduced me to New Gods, who at that time was being drawn by Michael Golden. And I saw Michael Golden's artwork, and I was like, holy crap. Michael Golden's artwork hit me just as hard as George Perez had hit me years earlier. And so anyways, now flash forward many, many, many years later, and about 10 years ago, I get invited to this show up in Spain. And this is northern Spain in a small town called Avila. And Avila is this really small town. With like the center of Avila always reminds me of, if you've ever watched the Rankin and Bass Santa Claus story, do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yes.
There's a scene where in Santa Claus, every time he goes into town, you see that little town square with a little fountain in the middle and cobblestone streets or whatever. That's what the center of Avilés, the city of Avilés, always reminded me of, that scene in Santa Claus is Coming to Town whenever Santa Claus was walking into town. And that's how picturesque it was. This beautiful little town, and they were having this big convention. And Michael Golden and George Perez were two of the artists who were also in attendance at that show. Now, by this point, I've become good friends with both of them. And the thing about becoming friends with artists in this is that you tend to easily forget that these guys were guys who inspired you. Suddenly, every time I saw George Perez, there was no awe. And it was just, oh, look here, there's George over there. And the same with Michael Golden. It's more a guy, Michael Golden. Like, Michael Golden doesn't really, Michael Golden is not at all a comic book nerd. He has like no emotional attachment to his artwork or anything. He doesn't geek out or anything like that. So, but anyways, I've become friends with these two guys, and I've known, and you know, this is for years now. We've known each other for years. And so there was one night, well, a bunch of us all went out to dinner, and they were going to go, a bunch of the people, they were going to go party afterward, and the dinner was already starting to get rowdy. And I remember thinking, like, you know, I've been here almost a week, and I'm really tired. I just want to go to the hotel room. So I excused myself from the table, and right away, Michael Golden looked at me. And he said, you know what? This is my out, too. So he said, okay, well, I'll walk you back to the hotel, Angel. And Perez, who had been drawing that whole freaking time, looked at him. He says, okay, well, I'll join you two guys, too. So the three of us walk out. And since this is in Spain, I remember having a open bottle of beer in my hand because we walk out the streets with beer. And as we were walking down the street, now this is nighttime now, and these old European places now, since they know that they're known for how old their town, you know, their the whole infrastructure is, you know, their cities, these are older than the country of the USA. Lights going on. It started to hit me like, holy crap, who would have ever thought I'd be here, you know? Northern Spain, a beautiful, beautiful town. And as we were talking, now, I would say this about George Perez. I don't know if you guys know this, but George Perez has been clinically diagnosed with a photographic memory. One of the reasons why he's so he loves to draw so many characters, particularly like Crisis, is because he likes to flaunt his ability that you can't stump George Perez. You can go up to him and say any character whatsoever, and he will draw it. A quick side note, I was at a show at Orlando one time, MegaCon. And they were having a contest called Stump George Perez, and it was a charity event that George always does all his artwork for charity. And so the whole, what it was is fans had to come up to George and come up with an obscure character and see if George couldn't draw it. And I remember that one guy, as a joke, went up to Perez and said, draw the pirates from that you too can learn how to draw ad that used to be in the back comics. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
And he said that as a joke. George Perez picked up the pencil and drew the freaking pirate. It shocked everybody, but that's before he really made an announcement that he has a photographic memory, and he does. I mean, another side note, at this party, convention we were, there was one night where we were having a party, and it was a movie trivia party. And I remember that I cheated because there was a movie trivia, and it had to do with the Audrey Hepburn movie, and I couldn't remember the name. But I knew that George Perez was in the vicinity, and he has a photographic memory. So I remember while everyone wasn't looking at me, George Perez walked by, and George, what's that one Audrey Hepburn film? And he turned to me, he says, oh, it's Wait Until Dark, came out in 1950, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I turn around, and I go, oh, Wait Until Dark. And I go, you got it. But, you know, I cheated.
Confession's good.
So anyway, because of George Perez having that photographic memory, come back to where I'm walking down the cobblestone street. Now, I am literally in the middle. I got Michael Golden on one end, and I got George Perez on the other. We're just chatting. And George Perez, with that photographic memory, I don't know what it was that we were talking about that led into this, but George Perez goes, oh, that reminds me. There was one issue of the Avengers I remember drawing, issue 148, where the Avengers fought the Squadron Supreme, it was inked by Romeo Tango. And as George Perez started recounting the details of this issue, it hit me. Holy shit, that's the very first Avengers I ever picked up. And then suddenly, you get one of those moments where the hairs on the back of your neck go up?
Yeah.
That it occurred to me, if I were to go back in time and tell that kid riding on that public bus, dude, years from now, you're going to be in Spain with George Perez on one end and Michael Golden on the other, and you guys are going to be talking shop. And that was one of those moments where I didn't let them in on it because I don't like to embarrass the creators about, like, you know, nerding out in front of them. But I remember thinking, like, holy shit, this is one of those cornball moments of where I should be saying, dude, I have got to be the luckiest MF-er on this planet. Because I'm in Spain, this beautiful town of Spain, with Michael Golden on one end and George Perez on the other. And they're proud enough to call me son. I mean, Michael Golden goes out of his way to look for me at conventions if I'm there. He goes, we got to get to dinner, you know, get to dinner. And that never occurred to me that it was just like, holy shit, this is how good you got. So that was right there one of the best, you know. The fact is that I've known him for years, but he didn't hit me until then. Then I realized, you know what? This has got to be one of the greatest moments of my career.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
And those European conventions are very different from U.S. conventions.
Oh, yes, very. As a matter of fact, this particular convention, it's funny because I remember when Golden came in, he came in a day after me. And the funny thing is that Golden brought, he did what I did. Golden brought a whole bunch of displays to the convention, and we didn't need the displays because this convention is just so hard for me to describe to people. The first day that I showed up, I was there with Liam Sharp. You know who Liam Sharp is?
Yeah. Right, he's drawn Hulk and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, he drew Hulk right before I jumped on. So anyways, the first day I flew in, I was with Liam Sharp. And so we're going down. So we're in the hotel. And this guy says, okay, we're going to take you down to the convention. And I said, okay, that's cool. And so as we're walking down these cobblestone streets again, and we go down to the center of town, I notice here's this big town square, which is really a big round circle. And I look and I go, where? I see no signs of the convention whatsoever. And there's this tiny little tent in the corner of the square. And they take us into this tiny little tent and only had two rows of dealers, that's all. And I had a table at the end. And they said, we need you to do an interview for the TV, for the local TV station. So me and Liam go up to the table, we do the interview. And the camera's right there in front of us. After we do the interview, we get out. And the guy who's our host, he leads us out. And as he's leading us out, suddenly a bunch of fans surround me and Liam and start talking to us. And as we start talking, the guy, our host, he drifts away from us. And now we're in the middle of this town square, a bunch of people walking about, you know, having dinner, you know, going to the stores or whatever. And me and Liam are surrounded by these fans. We sit down at one of the outdoor cafes, and the guy, one of the waiters, comes out. He starts giving us little drinks, little finger sandwiches. And we're out in this beautiful weather, you know, just a bunch of guys talking comics, enjoying beer and these finger foods and stuff. And we're sitting there and we're talking. In the middle of our discussion, a couple of the fans start to ease these sketchbooks in front of me and Liam. And so me and Liam, we start sketching while we're talking. But it really is just a bunch of guys having fun talking comics. And it stays like that. 1 hour passes by and 2 hours pass by. And in my mind, I start thinking like, oh, man, they're going to get mad at us because we really should be at this convention. And instead, we're out here, you know, goofing around with these guys, you know. And then the host shows up, and he claps his hand real loud to get everyone's attention. He goes, okay, sorry, guys, I have to break this up, but we're taking these two guys out to dinner. So me and Liam get up, and so I go to the host, and I said, hey, when are you going to take us to the convention? And he looks at us, he goes, are you kidding me? This is the convention.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And then, so we were there for a week. And like I said, it was a bunch of me, Gene Ha, Liam Sharp, George Perez, Michael Golden, all these artists were there. And if you, Corey, were to suddenly show up at this town square, you would not know it was a convention. You just think it's a busy town square outside, a bunch of people all sitting at all the various outside cafes eating. Except you would notice at one end of the cafe tables is George Perez. But if you look across the street, you can see, look, there's Gene Howe over there. What? Over on that block is, you know, Liam Sharp. And you'd be like, what the heck? You know, why all these comic book artists? And that was their version of a convention. No building, no, you know, comic book dealers, no displays, no nothing. Just a whole bunch of guys sitting around a cafe drinking and talking comics.
And there is I so wish that we could get conventions like that here in the U.S. I don't know how it would be possible because of having to pay for things and all, because a lot of the European conventions, they actually have government help to pay for these because they're considered artistic. You know, it's part of the artistic budget that they use and everything. But those conventions sound so much better than ours.
Oh, yeah. That's a funny thing you mentioned that because this convention, this is, you know, I've been to Europe a couple of times, but I'll use this, I'll continue to use this Spain one as an example. You're absolutely right. It was 100% funded by the government. But because of that, that's why they didn't need dealers there because they didn't really even need to make any profit there.
Yeah.
And one of the, and that's one of the reasons some artists won't do European, like, no, I know Alex Ross won't do European shows. And the reason why is because you don't make any money at the shows because Europe, they're so into the art of the comic books there that it's almost considered an insult to charge for head sketches. And that's, we were there for a week, and all we were doing was drawing all week long for these fans, and we weren't getting paid a dime for any of this stuff. And so, I mean, I drew it. I must have drawn at like 500 head sketches, because I was there for a little more than a week. And I did not get paid a single dime for it. And, you know, getting back to George Perez, that's the whole point of this thing, is that was the example. I'd seen George at different shows, and I'd seen him draw. George, out of all the artists there, drew way more. He drew us under the table easily. The funny thing is we would draw when we were out in that town square, but when we got to the hotel or any other, you know, we want to go sightseeing, there was no drawing. You know, that was usually an unspoken rule. George was not like that. George was such a popular guy. Let me tell you, George is such a popular artist anywhere that he goes that, when I first showed up at this convention, George was at the, I met George at the airport. And so we took the same, me, him, and Gene Howe, we took the same cab to the hotel. And as we were walking into the hotel, as soon as the door of the front lobby opened and we walked in, there was this thunderous applause. And it was for George Perez because he had just entered the building. That's how popular he was. And so obviously he had the biggest group of fans around him. And George, he every single time I saw him, he was always drawing. There was after the convention and the dinner, people would go to the square and get really rowdy. Everyone would just go out and get drunk and stuff like that. And George Perez was there, and we would be up to like 3 or 4 in the morning. You know, everyone's partying and drinking. So George was there. George is not a drinker. He was there because he was still doing sketching. He was drawing to like 4 in the morning. When I asked him for that Audrey Hepburn movie reference, he had a pad and paper and his pencil because he was drawing for a fan. He drew the whole freaking time we were there. And our last day, they took us to go see the Roman baths that were there in the northern Spain as a tourist thing. And he was still walking around with a sketch and pen still drawing. So that guy was just nonstop. And if you see him at any convention, you will always see him. He's constantly, because he's always being requested to draw, get something. And George Perez has never, ever, to me, I've never seen him ever turn anyone down. He would just be drawing. But if you know George, you would see that he's a guy, he has this attitude of like, I can't believe I got to draw comic books for a living. So this is sort of his way of, like, I guess, giving back to everyone. You'll never, ever in your lifetime meet a man who gave as much of his talent as George Perez has to the fan. It's hard for you to meet a fan who hasn't been to a convention. If you meet a fan who went to a convention in Georgia, more than likely he's going to at least have a head.
The fact that he has done so much, you know, I was sitting down to go, okay, what are my 5 favorite Perez runs? And I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Because you just keep thinking of so many of the milestones he did. He did that run. He did 2 runs on the Avengers in the 70s and 80s, and then another one in the 90s. The New Teen Titans, Wonder Woman, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Avengers JLA. Just, you know, hit after hit after hit, success after success after success. And one of the things that just keeps coming back to me when I think about it is, I wish because he said in his retirement thing, look, I have more than enough money to live on with royalties and this and that. I wish everyone could say that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Not only should George Perez have a really nice house that he could retire to, but there should be a whole row of them.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
And it's a shame that we don't have that. And I think that's why everybody's kind of a, he's retiring?
Yeah.
What?
It's funny because now that you mentioned that, it harkens back to me when I was a kid and when I would imagine what the life of a comic book artist would be like. And when I think about it now, it didn't hit me until you just said what you just said. That this is what I imagine the lifestyle of a comic artist should have been when I was a little kid. I mean, since I've grown up, you know, reality hits you and see how things really are. But when I was a kid, and if you would have asked me I would have imagined the life of a comic book artist. Now I think about it, it's the life that George Perez was. Because his whole life is pure comic book. Like I said, you never saw him go drinking out after the cons or whatever. And if you ever talked to him, there's one convention I remember, I think it was in L.A., where I went out for breakfast, and the table next to me in the restaurant, Lynn Wine was sitting there with George Perez. And I remember hearing George, the conversation that they were having. And George Perez was talking to comics with this guy. I mean, they've been in the industry forever. And whenever I meet any of these old guys, I get the feeling that they don't want to talk about comics because they've been in it for so freaking long, you know? And to hear George Perez still talk about comics, you know, you would have thought that they would have exhausted, you know, what they could talk about. And yet, here I heard him talking with Dwayne Wilson about it. And I was just like, wow, this guy is just, he's just nonstop. George Perez is almost like the epitome of comic books in human form.
Well, Angel, as an artist, what are the things that really jump out at you about Perez's art? What are the things, you know, us as fans, we can point to the fact that he does great crowd scenes and really good fights and, you know, the choreographing and the way
the
he
women,
does
don't
that.
Forget the women.
But what is it about an artist when you look at his pages and just kind of go, there's no way I can ever do that?
The dynamic. George Perez had, when I was a kid, the first thing that got me Perez more than any other artist out there was how dynamic he made everything look. You know, as I'm talking to you guys right now, I've got that for Avengers 148 in front of me, and I'm looking at the pages. I look at every panel, and there's a scene where a character, the amphibian, is trying to grab onto the Hellcat. And the shot where she's jumping over him and he's missing her and then he crashes into a window. I look at that and I go, man, that's pure comic book dynamic right there. He did not skim, not just in the detail, but in his storytelling. You know, if you're going to tell the story about this, you're going to make it look dynamic as he possibly can. He never skimped at all on that dynamic. And that to me was the first thing that grabbed me. There was more on top of it that, you know, I started picking up more as I got to, you know, become more of a George Perez fanatic. But that was the first thing that grabbed me when I was a kid. And to this day, that's still the first thing that grabs me now. I got into a discussion a couple of days ago with a guy on Facebook. I'm a fan of a bunch of the comic book groups that they got on there. And the discussion went on to Mike Zeck. And there was one guy who had asked me, because he asked me sort of the same question you did, except in terms of Mike Zeck. And I was trying to explain to this guy what I liked about Mike Zeck, but I was trying to do it in a way that didn't give off the parts of Mike Zeck that I didn't like. Because Mike Zeck, to me, was one of those artists that he's such a fan favorite. But as an artist, I looked at him, I go, yeah, I like his great parts, but boy, his weak parts were really, really turned me off. And George Perez was like the opposite of that. I couldn't see that at all. Mike Zeck, the reason he had his weak parts is because as an artist, I can see the parts that he doesn't want to draw.
Yeah.
And so I can see, he's not putting that much effort into that part. He doesn't like to do this. It's sort of like John Buscema's Spider-Man. Buscema was such a beautiful artist in terms of everything that he would draw. You look at everything he would draw, but then when you see his Spider-Man, you could tell, this guy does not like to draw Spider-Man. It just didn't look good. Whereas Perez was the opposite. Everything that came was put in front of Perez. It was like, okay, I'm going at this full force no matter what. You know, I'm looking at another page right now, 148, and it has, let me count one. 12 panels on. And I'm looking at every single panel, and I'm looking, Perez put 100% into every single panel. And I always thought that that's what you were supposed to do. And I've been criticized by editors before by them telling me, in order to speed up my deadline, they would tell me, like, you know, and those headshots that you do, you don't have to put that much effort in. They wanted me to concentrate on the big splashy money shot. But when they would tell me, I'd think to myself, but George Perez wouldn't do that, you know? George Perez would put as much effort into showing a close-up, you know, if it was a small panel that showed a close-up of someone's eyeball, he would put as much effort into that as he would into, like, a bubble paper spread.
Yeah, Angel, you were saying that, and I was, you know, just thinking one of the critical moments, and we were talking Crisis of Infinite Earths, is when Supergirl dies. And there's that shot where she realizes she's going to die. That's just her eye as she's turning towards the anti-monitor, and she's like, oh no. And then, boom, gets it. I mean, that's a perfect example of what you just said. Nothing's wasted there.
Yeah.
And the other thing about his art, you know, as a story, you know, I'm into comics for stories. The art is great and stuff, but I, you know, I'm a writer. I look at the story. When I read Focus on George Perez, and then he and Marv Wolfman talking about Titans back in the 80s, you would think that George Perez, oh, he's the guy who comes up with the big fight scenes. He's the guy who's, you know, planning the, you know, all the explosions and all that, because that's fun to draw. But Wolfman said, no, he's the one who makes me write the small scenes, the scenes where Cyborg's going to see his family, where Wally West is writing a letter to his parents. Perez wanted to do that stuff too, rather than just, here's the big money page that I can sell.
Oh, yeah.
He was really into the humanity of the characters. And I think it's because, as you talked about, he just had a love for the comics.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about his love for comics. He's, you know, it's funny because the majority of the artists that I meet from his period, how should I put this? I have this thing. I don't know if I ever told you about this. I have this thing that one of the reasons I go to a lot of comic book conventions is to meet my idol. And I don't, what I don't do when I meet my idols is I don't become a fanboy. I don't drool and go in awe in front of them, because I notice a lot of these guys, they're not used to that. A lot of these guys, we forget, they really didn't want to get into comics that much. It was almost like, well, I couldn't make it in advertising or whatever, so I do comics, you know. And so I got into this habit of whenever I meet the guys that I grew up with, don't follow them, just take them out to dinner, and eventually you'll start talking shop. But I always withheld the fanboy part of me. And George Perez was the only guy that I didn't feel like I had to do that. As a matter of fact, the first couple of times I first met him, I couldn't get a word in edgewise, because I would talk to him, and right away, you just bring up any subject, and suddenly you're going to get an explosion of facts and details, not just because of photographic memory, but also he loves to talk to you. I mean, he wants to tell you. I mean, you come up to him and you say, like, if Joe came up to him and said, like, you know, that close-up of Supergirl's eye that you did in Crisis, that's all Joe would be able to say, because now you get deluged with a bunch of stuff that George Perez was telling him about. Oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, I was thinking about this one movie where they showed this close-up of the eye, and I remember thinking, well, I want the inker to be able to do this, and blah, 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 and you get more information than you probably expected from him.
Well, we've talked for about an hour, so I thought what we could do before we go into all the other stuff that we talk about, you get to choose one Perez run of books to keep.
One.
Yep, you're going to be stranded on an
island. I got five. There ain't happening. I'm going to go five because I'm a rule breaker. But I'm not going to gab about it a lot. I'll just flip through them quick because a lot of it we've already talked about. I mean, I mean, I'll just rattle them off quick. The New Teen Titans run, the Avengers Buziak run, the Wonder Woman, Crisis on Infinite Earth, JLA Avengers. Those would be, to me, if we're going to do a Perez omnibus, those would be the ones that would be included. And a lot of these, for me, I think the most personal ones would have to be the Teen Titan run, because this is back in my golden age of comics. I started later than you two. mine being the first Amazing Spider-Man 178. So we're in the age of the X-Men. Uncanny X-Men is the king of the heap, and then suddenly we hear about the Teen Titans George Perez, and it was in DC Comics Presents 26, which had itself a kick-ass Jim Starlin Superman Green Lantern story. I mean, I'm still remembered when the villain of the piece, this is the Jim Starlin piece, stole Green Lantern's ring, and he's going up against Superman, and Superman just goes against this guy, and you see Hal on the planet covering his ears, boom, as the whole cosmos shakes, and Superman comes back with the villain in one hand and his ring in the other, and he's like, yeah, there's not much that's going to stop me when I put my will to it. He just kind of casually flips the ring back to Hal. But in the middle of that, and this is why, if you have a mint copy of DC Comics Presents 26, keep it protected, because it's over a $300 book. It's the first appearance of the new Teen Titans. First Cyborg, first Raven, first Starfire. It gets reprinted later, but this was a brilliant thing that DC did, is they put these little inserts in just enough to whet your appetite for the same price. This was like 50 cents. And then that was, let's see, that was October. And then the following month, oh, new Teen Titans number one. And it hit the ground running. He went through, let's see, what did I write down? 40 issues, four annuals, plus five Baxter before George Perez dropped off and did it. And it includes so much stuff. I've been rereading it. And when they come out, I think the whole run might be done, where one more book coming where they're doing the George Perez new Teen Titans. Well, and Marv too, he was there for it, obviously. And one of the books you guys talked about, or one of the things you were talking about earlier, was just the human moments. One of my absolute favorite books, which I, every time I see it in the 50 cent box, I buy it just because I'm afraid I don't have it, is the Tales of, was it New Tales of the New Teen Titans, or was there the Titans in number 50, the marriage between Wonder Girl and I can't remember the name of the husband. Corey?
I don't remember his name either.
Okay, give me that Nickelback. So anyways, but that is nothing but
Nickelback.
A human interest thing. Tons of
open my mouth a little bit.
Slight continuity. There's scenes where like these women are like, oh my God, who's that? And they're looking out at Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne talking on the balcony. These women are just drooling. The conversation is Dick's asks point blank, you know, and back then they're doing a now non-continuity bit where Batman is fighting to adopt Jason Todd. This is before they threw all that out and just made him a dumbass who like hacks Batmobile tires. And Dick asks him, why didn't you adopt me? And there's a momentary pause, and he says, well, I was too fixated on my momentary career as a Batman. But I've never had a finer person. As far as I'm concerned, you're my son. Beautiful human interest story that was probably did more for their relationship. And then, of course, what we talk about as the game changer, and again, this is probably the ultimate blow of a fanboy's mind, is when Crisis on Infinite Earths hit. And, you know, even JLA Avengers, as cool as it was, cannot overestimate just how mind-boggling this series was to, you know, I'm probably 5-10 years in, and I still have the excitement when I read this, because everything on it. I remember walking into the comic store, St. Paul Comics, and John Nunziata has the first issue. He goes, oh, dude, they told you. It was going to be bloody. And he's, look at this. And he shows me, they cack everybody on Earth 3 within the first couple scenes. I knew all the Earths. I was not confused by the Earths. Matter of fact, the fact that I knew Earth S exists means my whole Shazam collection was perfect. You know, everything fit in somehow. Maybe not Mopey, but, you know, everything fit in somehow. And when that crisis started, you knew this was going to be bloody. Corey and I have played games on a previous podcast where we said, what would we have done after Crisis? Check that podcast out, because it was a lot of fun. But, you know, the Crisis in and of itself was just immensely satisfying. Yeah, I mean, you take that, Infinite Crisis and Final Crisis, as far as I'm concerned, DC Universe ended with Final Crisis. And, you know, like I said, if I had my way and I was God, I would put my magic finger down and give Perez his youth and his writing ability, his drawing ability back, and just say, guess what? You're writing everything, drawing everything. Yeah. Don't care what it is. You do it. Sorry, I've geeked on enough. Who else wants to go? What's your favorite run or runs? I'll toss it to Corey. I'll toss it to Angel. Okay. Corey talks enough.
Go ahead, Angel.
Well, mine is easily by far the Avengers run, because that defined my childhood. As I told you before, 148 was the very first Avengers issue I ever had in my hand. It was by George Perez. And that was the very, even though I had my whole childhood, I had collected comics. I grew up so poor that I had to be very selective of the comics I got. So I only went through, but the one series I never missed was the Avengers when I was a kid. And when I got old enough and I discovered all the back issue ads that they used to have there and be able to pick, I made it my life's goal to try to pick up as many of the Avengers issues as I could. But all of that was centered around all the George Perez issues, where it'd be starting from the very early storyline with Squadron Supreme all the way ending up to where, you know, Jarvis is on the cover with the vacuum cleaner. That every issue in between there, even though they weren't all George Perez, they were still part of the George Perez era of comics. And so for me, that was it. I mean, as a kid, my dream project was to draw. I wanted to be the artist who followed up George Perez's run on the Avengers, just because I remember it was my goal when I was a kid. Like, I want to be known as, when you think Avengers, the first thing you think is George Perez. I wanted to be the second name you thought of when you thought of the Avengers. And that would have been a possibility if the Brian Bendis era of the Avengers had not begun. Because before Bendis, they hired Bendis to completely redo the Avengers. I had this very detailed proposal that I had put together to show Marvel, to show them that I'd like to be the new creator on the Avengers, because at that time they didn't have any direction. Only problem is by the time I was ready to show it, Brian, you know, they decided to revamp the Avengers, and then they just completely stopped the continuity and went a completely different route. But getting back to the subject they were talking about, it's that's the run that will always be number one for me. Although I can understand Joe's point of the difficulty of trying to choose just one. For me, the reason I can choose is because that defined my childhood and also defined the whole reason I got into comics to begin with. But then when I heard Joe talk, I also remember going to the store and picking up the New Teen Titans for the first time and looking at that and thinking, before the New Teen Titans came along, I had sporadically picked up DC Comics. I was much more of a Marvel guy, hardcore Marvel guy before that. But when the New Teen Titans came out, what I saw was all the dynamics that I loved with Marvel was now being applied to DC for the very first time. And it was through George Perez. Because if you look at those first issues of the Teen Titans, and you look at the new characters that were introduced at that time, whether it be Starfire, Cyborg, or the reincarnation of Beast Boy and Changeling, I look at those characters and I go, those are Avengers characters. Those are characters that look like they belong in the Avengers, especially when you look at their costumes. I thought, those guys are characters that you would see in the Avengers, in the DC universe. And I wasn't used to seeing that really dynamic Marvel style in DC until George Perez came along and brought it there. And then, to me, that's what swung, from there on in, DC, that shifted all of DC, because if you remember after that, suddenly DC started becoming popular again, because before that, Marvel was, you know, the name to go to when you wanted comics. And then after that, because it started happening at DC after that, where, you know, suddenly John Byrne was coming aboard, and then suddenly the story was starting to get better and all that stuff. So for me, Teen Titans is probably a close second, but I still have to go with the Avengers as my number one definitive run as far as the Avengers. And that literally is true. If I was on a desert island, and I could only choose one thing. It would be all the Avengers, because I listen to them. Out of my collection of the Avengers that I own, during the Perez era, I would say about 80% of the comics I own are still the same comics I had when I was a kid. Now, it got doubled, so I'm in better condition. But like the Avengers 148 that I got in front of me, I'm looking at it, it's all crumpled up and everything.
Once again, there were technical difficulties. I don't want to get into the details, but we did have to update Skype. Skype has finally forced us to update. So we are using Skype's recorder, which actually dropped out at one point while I was talking. Angel asked me what my favorite George Perez work was, and I hemmed and hawed for a little while and then finally said that it has to be Avengers JLA, not just because it was a big story that was very worthy of George's propensity to draw a bunch of characters, not just showing that he remembered how all of the characters looked through all the years he drew them, but it's one of the few things where he inked himself. George has had a lot of wonderful inkers like Mike DiCarlo and Al Vey and Romeo Tangal and Jerry Ordway, but this is the only thing I can think of where George inked himself for the whole time, and he inked himself on all four issues of Avengers JLA, and it's just gorgeous because he understood exactly what detail he wanted to highlight. And I really wish that we could have gotten more work that where George inked himself. Oh, and after I talked a little about my favorite George Perez story, I told people that, we have ads. That's right, here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we have ads. And our first sponsor is me. That's right, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard. I have my first book out with Dangerous Dan Moore. It's the first 100 strips of our online web strip, Worldwide News, the story of the lowest-rated cable news network. And you can get yourself a copy with commentary, with all sorts of extras, with signatures and everything. Just email Dan over at lordshadowflame@gmail.com. Our top sponsor, who's been with us since day one, is DreamHost. DreamHost.com. You need yourself a website, and DreamHost.com is the number one web host in the whole known universe. Just head over to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, get $20 off your first year. How can you beat that? Our other sponsor is Graze, G-R-A-Z-E.com. Healthy snacks for a healthy lifestyle. Just head over to Graze, put in the code CORYS3R5P. Your first and fifth box are free. You can get them weekly. You can get them bi-weekly. You can get them monthly. You just order a whole bunch of them. It's great stuff to keep you away from the vending machine at work. Now, if you would like to leave a comment for any of the podcasts that we do, we'd love those. Go ahead and email us at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, or you can call 952-856-0519. Operators are standing by. Okay, it's just a place that we'll record your calls, but we'll play them on the air. We'll answer your questions. We love getting feedback. Tell us what you think. Ask a question. Suggest a topic. Be a guest. Send us your stuff. SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose radio shows, you can. Just email us at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. Thanks. And there are other podcasts I do. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network has all sorts of podcasts. We've got Scrabbling Across the West with Dave Cafell and his lovely bride, Stephanie. They travel across the country playing musical gigs, and at night they sit down to play Scrabble and talk about their day at scrabbling.solitairerose.com. There's Novelcast over at novels.solitairerose.com, where I take the novels that I've written and turn them into audio podcasts. Currently, we are doing a novel called Do the Job, which is a murder mystery set in the world of 1980s professional wrestling. Then over at badadvice.solitairerose.com, me, Corey Strode, and Wolfie B. Bad, along with Dan Moore, give bad advice to people who send in questions. That's bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is growing. Be there! You think NBC will get mad I used that? So hopefully next episode we'll have gotten the whole new, brand new Skype thing all figured out. Or not. You know how terrible we are with technology.
do get calls. Like, I'll get calls like from IDW or whatever, and they'll say like, "Hey, we got this cover we want you to do." And then I look at it and I go, "I guess I can do that, you know, just get my name out there." But then I get followed up by, you know, like for instance, this guy Mike Blanchard, I just told you, he just offered me, he said, "I'll pay you this much if you do a double page spread of," he said, "either Moon Knight fighting the Legion of Monsters or." There's a character, a Ghost Rider villain called, what was the guy with the eyeball? He was a Ghost Rider villain.
Oh, the Orb.
Yeah, he said, "How about or the Orb fighting the Legion of Monsters, you know, as a double page spread?" And I thought, oh shit, I would love to do a double page spread of the Orb fighting the Legion of Monsters. So it's between that and a cover that IDW wants me to do that I really don't have that much interest in, but it will get my name out there. So that's kind of the fuzzy answer I'm giving you as far as it's hard for me to get something. I'm trying my darndest to get something out there with my publishing, but at the same time, the money keeps kind of swaying me to one end or another. So that's a hard question for me to answer because I still want to really put something out there. But boy, the way the internet is right now, it's just making it really hard for, you know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand, because there's probably a reason that there are a lot of artists where you go, well, where are they? Like Adam Hughes. I imagine Adam Hughes gets huge money for a commission, more than he can get for a comic. Oh, yeah, you
know, what people don't know about Adam Hughes is that, and don't worry, it's not like he's trying to keep it a secret or anything. Adam Hughes will get an offer from George Lucas. George Lucas will call him up and say, "Listen, I got a new summer home, and I really want a big Star Wars piece in the middle of it framed up. Could you do me one?" I mean, he offers Adam Hughes, you know, a shitload of money, and it's a piece that no one's ever going to see. And but you think Adam Hughes is going to? And then he gets Adam Hughes at the same time, he gets an offer from DC saying, like, "You should be drawing Wonder Woman." But what he's going to get paid to draw an entire, you know, 22-story of Wonder Woman isn't even, you know, 3/5 of what, you know, Lucas is going to pay him to do this private piece. I'm a fan of one of his group on Facebook, and you see people constantly putting up all this artwork, and now private artwork is starting to come up from Adam Hughes. Someone just put up a piece that Adam Hughes did for someone. It was a private piece for Firefly, and I saw this piece and holy shit, that is just gorgeous, but no one ever sees it. But when I looked at that piece, I thought, oh, I know he got paid a pretty good penny for that. You know? So that's the hard part when all of it. Someone came up to Alex Ross. I was with Ross, this was years ago, at a signing that he was doing. And I remember someone came up to him and they kind of asked Ross, like, you know, this is when Ross was putting out that book that I don't remember if you remember, Ross actually put out an art book of his artwork out.
Yes.
And, it was a large part of it was finding it through Ross because he wanted creative control of this thing. And someone came up to him and said, "Man, well, you know, we really like this stuff. This art book you put out." And they said, "But why didn't someone like Adam Hughes create?" And I could tell that what the fan was trying to say is like, "Yeah, Ross, you're good, but, you know," you're trying to insinuate that Hughes is better than Ross. And Ross picked up on that, and what I like Ross, the way he responded, was Ross was saying, "Oh, I agree with you. I think Adam Hughes has much more of a right to be putting out art books than I do. But the big difference is that I actually do it." And he does. And that's true. It's because I'm sure you guys have met Adam, because he used to do Limit. He used to do the Minnesota show a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But if you meet Adam, Adam is kind of like Michael Golden, that he has a certain emotional detachment to his art. He doesn't get into it as most people think he does. And so Adam is more into playing poker than he is into his art.
Yes, and I know.
And so because of that, if someone comes, George Lucas is knocking on his door and saying, "Listen, I'll give you this much money," Adam, I think he's thinking, "This is my all good. That means I don't have to work for a year, and I can just go play poker that whole freaking." So that's sort of where, you know, a lot of us artists are at right now. There's an artist right now. There's a couple of artists, Jason Pearson. And who's the other guy in the studio guy, the black guy? Do you know who I'm talking about? I'm brain farting on him right now.
X-Men guy?
You know the original Gaijin Studio guys, right?
Yeah, but I can't remember who it was.
Stelfreeze, that's what it was.
Oh, Brian Stelfreeze, yeah.
Yeah, Brian Stelfreeze and Jason Pearson are two of the best comic book artists, in my opinion, right now, at this moment. They're at the level of where Adam Hughes is, as far as I'm concerned, but you rarely see them doing anything published. And the reason why is because, like I said, the internet kind of spoiled it first. These guys, they get offers, you know, they join Facebook and suddenly they're getting offers, you know, private pieces and stuff. And they, we get paid, I get paid 10 times more by fans than what Marvel and DC are going to pay. So do you see where the dilemma there lies?
Oh, yeah.
And especially since, you know, I got offered to do Hawkman about 3 years ago from DC. And I said, well, send me reference on what Hawkman looks like. Because I thought, oh, I'd love to draw Hawkman. But then when they sent me the reference, I thought, that's not Hawkman. And so now they're going to pay me very little money to draw a character that I don't really have that much heart to do. You know, and so I ended up not doing it just because I just thought, I don't want this to turn into something I don't like doing. I don't want a comic book to become something
a
that
job.
I don't like. Yeah, yeah. I don't want it to become a job. It's hard, you know, when I left Marvel, people were shocked because I didn't renew my contract. I remember Marvel was really surprised. My former editor came up to me, this is after he left Marvel, and he was just like, yeah, you really threw us for a loop. You didn't re-sign with us. And I was like, did you figure out all the arguments I had with the, what they, Marvel like to call them, the guys upstairs? I was on the phone literally yelling with these guys. And I thought, like, man, I got to go back into that. You know, I signed a contract, 5-year contract with Marvel. They're not going to pay me as much as I used to. It's going to be a bunch of characters there. You know, they're going to stay here, draw, you know, give me a character. Yeah, draw Adam Warlock. I see what Adam Warlock looks like now. He doesn't look anything like what I grew up with. I'm just like, why would I want to draw that? You know, it's just not any fun for me. So that's
well, and they're also not as dynamic with their stories. You know, the the stories have better storytelling, but there's less of the, you know, the fight scenes that and I, when we read comics, it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna get to see these two guys throw down. They don't have as much of that anymore. And I imagine for older artists, it's like, okay, yeah, I don't want to draw two guys standing around chatting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny. One of the very last issues I did, it never got published. I did I started an Avengers project with Brian Michael Bendis. And I only got eight pages into it. And I called the editor and I said, is there any way you can get me out of it? And I remember one of the reasons why, there was a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons why, because there was one page that Bendis wanted me to do, actually it was a double page spread. And each page, even though it was a double page spread, each page had like a total of like 25 panels on there. So I had to draw all these tiny little panels. And it was a dialogue between Tony Stark and Jessica Drew. And it was their faces, and it was just a small face. And the way, and Bendis, he likes to lay things out real quick with thumbnails.
Yeah.
And send them to the artist. So he sent me this thumbnail. So, and he wanted 25 panels of the exact same shot of Tony Stark's face, just making small, subtle changes to the facial expression. So I couldn't even just, you know, I had to draw the exact same shot of Tony Stark's face. But I couldn't, you know, in the old school days, you just make a Xerox and you multiply it, you know, 25 times. I couldn't even do that because I had to draw each face just with a subtle change in the expression of the face. And I thought, Jesus Christ, and I got into this business to draw superheroes, and I'm drawing this normal face of a normal guy for 25 panels in the exact same angle. You know, and I just thought, that's an artist's nightmare. There's no creativity in that. So I took a certain liberty in that there was one panel that required to show how he was feeding, but he was trying to hold in his angle. So I drew a couple of panels of that face, but then when it got to that shot where he's supposed to be feeding but trying to hold it in, instead I broke up the monotony of those panels and I drew this really long, thin, horizontal panel that focused just on his lip. And I drew, you could just barely see his teeth gritting. And I thought that's more powerful and impactful, showing a close-up of the lip and just seeing his teeth grit just barely underneath them, you know. And I thought, okay, that's more fun, and that portrayed better, in my view, of what Bendis was going for. Boy, when Bendis got a hold of that, the crime that he did to the editor was like, why is he breaking up my, you know, the flow of what we're trying to do? And I remember thinking, like, you know what, they just stopped paying me enough. You know, this was an Avengers project. I had dreamed my whole life to draw an Avengers, and yet it was such a torturous ordeal that I had to get out of that. And I just thought, you know, the writing's on the wall there. Marvel thinks that I want to stay with them because, you know, they're Marvel, they're the big name or whatever. But I just thought, this is, Corey, seriously, I hated getting up in the morning and having to walk to my drawing desk. And this was an Avengers project.
Well, Joe, do you want to talk about what's going on the eBays?
Are we going to do Freakin' and Geekin'?
Of course we are.
Well, I'll talk about it then.
Well, then, now we get to my favorite part of the show. No, break. Not where I go on and on about how, damn it, I have to go to Walmart once a month to buy DC Comics.
And pretty soon Target.
I don't mind going to Target.
Oh, okay.
But no. It's Freakin' and Geekin'. Joe, what are you freaking on?
Screwed up something in my hip, and I'm not talking. I need another hip, which I will eventually. But something popped in one of the muscles, and I was really sore to the point where I couldn't exercise. It was hard to walk. I was like, "Oh my God, I feel as bad as I did 2 weeks after the surgery." And I went in and talked to the doctor. I just so happened I did it the overnight. From, you know, seeing the physical therapist, he gave me a bunch of exercises to going to see the doctor for my 6 week checkup. And he thought I didn't crack anything, which would have sucked. But he thought maybe I popped an internal stitch because, you know, when you tear apart all the muscles, you put them together with internal stitches. And after about 2-3 days of rest, I seemed to be getting back. But, you know, and I'm back doing my exercises again, and I'm like, holy shit, it's like I haven't even done them. Oh, so get out there, exercise. Get it from the comic board, the computer. Matter of fact, I'd like to do that. But by the time this here podcast drops, I get to go back to work. I don't get paid for it. You know, kind of like an artist who's doing it for the exposure, I guess. I'm just not going to get paid. You know, at least
you know, people die of exposure.
Yeah, well,
hey, can I ask Joe a question real quick about all of this?
Too, sure. Well, oh, sure.
I'm just curious, and I'm not trying to get into anything in the discussion about this. This is just to answer a real simple question. When this is over, because there is going to be a point when this is all over, are you guys going to get compensated for all this time?
Well, what generally happens from the last one, and since I've been with TSA for 16 years, we've gone through two of them where the government shuts down and we have to go to work because we're essential, said with air quotes. What Congress does is they will pass something so that you get paid. And what that means is everybody who's been furloughed gets money. If you are on vacation, if you took sick time, they don't take it from you. For us that worked, that just means we get paid. You see, the better deal is if you were furloughed and you got paid for the time you were off because you didn't lose anything. Whereas with TSA, we're just going to get the money. The problem is this has been the longest one that I'm aware of. And so now you're talking a lot of us have gone 2 paychecks without we're coming up to the second one without getting paid. You know, you kind of hit it upon the head. You know, you want to do this, but you got to do that because the money comes in. Well, there are people who are quitting, you know, people who've been on the job maybe less than a year, like, screw this. I'm going to quit, go somewhere else. There's other people that got to stay home for their kids because they can't afford daycare. There are people that are, I will come back to work when I get paid, but I got to go work a second job somewhere. And then there's people like me. I've been out for 2 months because of having hip replacement. And I had the money set up to cover it. And now we're getting into the point where I'm expected to go back to work. And I'm like, well, I'm going back to work with no idea I'm getting paid. Well, you know, my father-in-law gave us a bequeathment, you know, as part of his tax thing, you know, as you get older or whatever. So I'm fine, but, you know, I've got friends who, they're married to someone who works in TSA and they work in TSA. I don't know what the hell they're going to do, you know? So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot. Oh, they signed a law saying we will get paid. We will get paid. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Angel, I want you to do an entire Corey the Strode, the Cleaner comic book, and I will pay you, I don't know, sometime in the future.
So. No, it's an angry situation no matter what, but I just wanted to make sure that, as angry as the situation is, that there's got to be some light at the end of the tunnel. That's why I just wanted to know.
That's the thing. Nobody knows when the light is. A lot of it is, you know, people are, why is Congress getting paid? Well, there's laws on the book that you cannot volunteer time for the federal government. It's like almost back to anti-slavery laws, that type of thing, which is why even though we're getting work, they have to pay us somehow. There's actually courts have ruled in on that. And there's been a couple other things where even recently where the courts are like, well, we're not going to rule that the government has to pay you now because we're not sure how this would play out. We know how it's going to play out. When the government opens up, you'll get your money, i.e. you get a big ass check and they take half of it in taxes. I don't see any sign that anything's going to change. And it's a bummer. You know, and part of it too, I had to think about it. It's like, do I want to go back to work? I mean, I'll talk about it in geeking. You know, I'm doing a lot on the eBays. I kind of dig sitting on my ass. I mean, I put on pants because I knew you were coming, but usually I just sit in my sweats and watch Star Trek reruns. And just recently I found out one of my daughters got Amazon Prime, so I can go watch Doctor Who, the new one, you know. I said, oh, now get CBS Access so I can get caught up on Discovery. But on the other hand, I eventually will want to get paid. And when I go back, it's only going to be part time. So I have a 10-hour day. I'll work 5 and then go home. So, you know, and again, if I get to work and it's too much and I'm not anticipating, well, I'll just say, hey, I can't do this. I'm going to have to go sit down and work my leg off a little. Get it a little stronger, but either way, I'm just gonna bite the bullet, get back to work. The only other thing really I'm freaking on is the Eisner Award judges were picked, and Corey, you and I, they bypassed us again.
Again,
I just don't understand.
We still don't have a Wikipedia page either, and that's really starting to chap my ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to tell you, this is how bad I am. I've gotten all, I get a ballot for that every year off the book of vote, and I don't think I voted in the past like 5 years.
I don't know what's happened.
Hey, Corey, Angel Medina's got a Wikipedia page. Although it says it needs additional citations for verification, so we may have to look at it.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine actually volunteered to fix that up for me. This was years ago, more than 10 years ago, because I remember at that time, I guess there was like an amateur wrestler named Angel Medina, and they somehow put our histories together. So I was Angel Medina comic book artist / wrestler for a little
Spider
while.
Oh, Spider-Man's going to kick your ass because that's his gimmick.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what they wanted. So a friend of mine actually volunteered to worked at the FedEx that I go to at that time, and he'd tell me, like, I can go on, because he was a big computer nerd thing, because I can go up there and fix it for you or whatever, but I stay away from anything that mentions me anywhere on the internet, just because I'm one of those guys. I don't want to know what people are saying about me. I don't want, you know, I remember way back in the old school days, before the internet and stuff, I was at a one convention, and there was this guy that we did a little bit of amateur comic book work at the time, and his name is Chris Decker. And I remember passing by him at the Chicago show, and he comes up to me and goes, oh, man, Angel, you got to do something about getting some kind of, somebody to do some damage control on your reputation. I had no clue what the hell he was talking about as far as, what the hell is going on? What are people saying about me? And I don't know when he told me, I'm thinking, I don't have the patience for this. I don't give this. This is more important. And I never found out what it was that he was talking about. And I thought, well, I don't know what kind of reputation I have. And so I stay away from all internet stuff because I just don't. My mind doesn't want, I don't want to have to deal with that right now. I just want to focus on, I want to become the new George Perez as far as, like, I know I can't do it artistic-wise, but I love George Perez in that he's such a comic book dynamo. It seems like that's all that encapsulates his mindset. That's what I want to focus on. If someone shows me something someone else does, then my mind will start wandering to why I should say that. No. I want to stay focused on why JL. You want to know what I want to focus on? I want to focus on the fact that here we are now. We passed this whole George Perez, and I never mentioned that badass Marvel 2-in-1 George Perez run that he did. That project kind of my favorite Marvel 2-in-1, and I never got the chance to bring that up during our George Perez discussion.
Fantastic run! Another one that I keep in my collection just because it's that. I mean, the story was awesome, and the art was brilliant.
And I remember
we're almost freaking here. I mean, do you got anything else you're freaking on, Angel?
Well, right now, my mind is just stuck on the George Perez thing because after I talked to you guys about it, I was actually looking through a bunch of my George Perez comics before. So right now, I think the only thing I am freaking out right now, and it started this afternoon, is all the George Perez stuff. And right now, really, it is that Marvel 2-in-1 thing because I did get in a discussion a couple of years ago with someone on Facebook about that. But I rarely ever get to talk about that whole, I mean, you know, Project Pegasus, Flash. Do you remember that George Perez ended his run with that the introduction of the serpent? What was it? The serpent?
Serpent crown? Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it called? The serpent one?
Serpent crown. And it was like serpent crown affair.
Yeah, but there was a group that they were introduced. They were like Anaconda and...
Oh.
The Serpent Squad, I believe.
Yeah.
Serpent Squad. Yeah. And George Perez introduced those new characters. Like, I remember Anaconda, and I think it was called Black Mamba, and they all had those great George Perez costumes on. Where it was, like, way more detailed than they needed to be.
And then Grunewald brought him over to Captain America, and they were, like, Captain America's main bad guys for a while.
Yeah. Actually, I talked to Ralph Macchio, who was close, he was, like, him and Grunewald were, like, best buds at the time, and Ralph Macchio was my editor at Marvel for a brief time, but I had talked to him about that because I told him, you know, I love Project Pegasus, and he told me that him and Grunewald came up with the whole Project Pegasus thing because they wanted all the writers at Marvel to have some place to put all these villains whenever they got defeated, because that was always one of those glitches that was in the Marvel universe. It was like when you beat a really powerful villain, like let's say the Blob. I mean, what do you do with a character like that after he gets his ass whooped? You know, he's unconscious, and the cops have to take him away, but where do you take these guys? And that him and Grunewald created that whole idea of Project Pegasus just because they wanted that to be something that all the writers could use. And Ralph said that after Grunewald passed away, he got frustrated because he noticed none of the writers were using Project Pegasus in any of their stories.
No, I think by then they were using The Vault.
Yeah.
Hey, Corey?
Yeah.
Serpent Squad has a Wikipedia page.
It's just not fair.
Nope. So, what are you freaking on, Strode?
That we don't have a Wikipedia page. No, I'm freaking out because I was reading over some stats for the comic industry, and I put them up on the Facebooks today, but there were 498 comics released in December.
Jeez.
248 graphic novels. So almost 600 line items for comic shops. There's too many damn comics.
I wonder our preview shows run into the 3-hour mark.
And then I was reading another thing. What was it? 10 years ago, there were 200 scripted series for television. Now there's nearly 500 per year. No wonder we all feel like, oh my God, I don't have time to watch all this stuff. I don't have time to read all this stuff. I don't have time. It's because they're putting out so much stuff.
Well, it makes the award shows boring too, because half the time you're like, And from this network, these people you've never heard on a show you'll probably never get to watch unless you subscribe to it. And I'm like, who? What?
What you know, it makes me wonder is that with all this stuff coming out, whether it be TV shows or comics and stuff, the people who are watching, I mean, they're not going to have the same kind of memory that we have. We remember, like, you know, we were talking about the, you know, whole Project Pegasus or whatever, because, you know, there weren't that much stuff out there, so we were able to grasp onto something and hold it as memories and stuff. But when they got stuff that are constantly coming out like this, it makes me wonder, I mean, who's going to remember this stuff, you know, years from now? Who's going to remember this stuff the way I remember Twin Peaks or the way that I remember, you know, the, you know, reading these certain comic book stories like that? If there's all this, just a huge deluge of stuff coming out.
Oh, yeah, and we talked about it about DC, too, because after New 52, nothing before that matters. It's like, yeah, they're reprinting it, and I'm geeking out, you know, when they come out with the omnibus or the reprint of things that I really want. But no one, you know, New Teen Titans, no one's going to, you know, maybe somebody might seek it out because they're listening to us, or but it has no relevance to anybody reading DC, at least currently.
And to me, the other thing it does when there's so much out there, there's no more what I call shared experience. Exactly. Recently, there was that movie on Netflix, Bird Box. And everywhere on Facebook, people were making jokes about it for a week, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, well, if you didn't have time to watch it the week it came out, well, people have already told you everything, and you know all of it. And it's, when I was a kid, when something was on TV, you know, Happy Days, we all would talk about Happy Days the next day. Or, you know, even into the 80s, I remember when Twin Peaks hit, I was working at Shinders. That next day, we would all sit around and, all right, we saw this and this happened, and what does this mean, and how does this tie in with it and everything? And there's something about, I think there's something about entertainment that makes it better if you talk about it.
I agree, yeah.
And now,
I will say, my wife, who's a connoisseur of horror movies, did not like Bird Box. Was not at all impressed with it. So, take that for what it's worth.
But stuff comes and goes so fast.
Well, where were you yesterday with the Eclipse Blood Moon? That was about the closest thing to a communal experience I got, not only because it was happening live on the Facebooks, but on YouTube, there's guys with big satellites that were, or telescopes right up front, and people were commenting and posting. That was probably the closest to a communal experience we'll get. With the exception of the guys like us who are going to be there at the midnight showing for the Avengers movie coming up.
But stuff just, you know, it used to be things could resonate a little bit. But now nothing resonates because it's, okay, you like that? Well, here's 50 more things.
Just wear your pants high when you say it. In my day, we had to wait a week. We didn't have, I did card catalogs. You don't know what it was like. We didn't Google everything.
In my day, a movie would stay in a movie theater for a month.
If I didn't have to give you a spoiler warning, I just smacked you side the head and said, shut up.
Here's your spoiler.
Can I tell my spoiler story about Return of the Jedi again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when Return of the Jedi came out, this was back before they had midnight shows. This was back, and Marvel spoiled it, by the way. If you went to the comic shop, you could pick up the Return of the Jedi adaptation 2 weeks before the movie came out. But, you know, first show, Return of the Jedi, I went to. Because, you know, it was summer. I was a teenager. Didn't have a job. So went with a friend. And we're coming out, and there's a big line for the people. Ready to see Return of the Jedi, the second show of the day. First day it opened, second show. So my friend and I were walking by, and I just, as loud as I could, said, man, that was amazing. I could not believe that we found out that Han Solo was Luke Skywalker's brother. And everybody in the line just started yelling at me.
And that, my friends, was the birth of a rat bastard.
Damn right. So, geeking, Joe, what you geeking on?
I'm going to just geek on one thing. I actually got to go to an old-fashioned comic book show. And it was kind of fun because People we knew there, our good buddy Steve Brown from Cedar Cliff, he brought that collection he picked up from Nick a while back, I guess, when I was geeking about last time. And I went through and I spent way, way, way too much money picking up things, partially because, I knew it was from Nick's collection, and some of it because I figured I could put it on eBay's, which is why I waited. Because if you go to the eBay's and you look for stuff that I posted on this here date, being the 21st, I found a lot of the variants and things that Nick picked up. Some fun things, like a zero hour that Marty Nodell did his, he sketches the year and the Green Lantern from 40s and a lantern. Some weird variants, like we talked about darker image, had the first Max. So I was able to find a gold copy, a platinum copy, and a regular copy. And I just put them together as a set. Some of those Marvel Authentics books that we've talked about in the past, where they came out, I think, was it 99? And they had little squares in them where you could go up and find the artists to draw on them. And some of them you could buy with the draw on them. A couple Amazing Hero swimsuit issues, which I think is a concept that they should bring back. If not to sell, they could certainly use it for one of the causes that we talk about, Heroes Initiative or the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. A couple autograph books, one by Tribe, the Mr. T and the T-Force. And I know I had mine that I had personally autographed by him. I've sold years ago. But the coolest thing I had, and I'm debating selling it, and I may take it down, I don't know. In 1999, at my insistence, Nick invited Frank Cho to come to the MCBA con. And this was about the time Liberty Metals was still being published through his own studio, before it hit Image, before Frank Cho was
Frank Cho.
Yeah, or like the way Adam Hughes is now. Frank Cho can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. Or he could just sit and bang out covers that piss off, I forget who the guy was, who outrageous. What's fun about this one is it comes with a certificate of authenticity saying that it was a first printing signed at the MCBA Fall Con. And I know people who, back then I didn't have I wasn't collecting original art for anything. And now I've since decided I would do with the 70s Supergirl outfit, the poofy sleeves and that. Angel did me a piece a couple of years ago. I actually have a George Prez piece that I got off the eBay's. It's when she was wearing the headband uniform, towards the end of her daring adventures of Supergirl, and how, the uniform she wore when she passed away in Crisis. So I do have a George Prez piece in my collection. But anyways, all this fun stuff's on the eBay's. If you want to check it out, KRAYZ. If you find something, if you buy something, let me know, because I always toss in something special for the listeners of our show. I did want to mention I'll mention one book. The other ones I'll mention next week, including the Pogs I picked up. But
Pogs?
Yeah, they're making a comeback, I did pick up a couple books that kind of tied in to what we're talking about. I found a cheap run, a buck a piece, of the History of the DC Universe. And it was cheap enough. But then again, when I got home, I discovered that I had a copy of it in my collection. And again, this is Wolfman and Perez. I forget if this came out after Crisis and was a aborted attempt of DC to streamline their universe. And it's fun reading, beautiful art. And it, like I said, has no bearing on anything currently, because with New 52, nothing is new anymore. It's all old. It's crap. It doesn't matter. But it's still beautiful. It's worth picking up. I also picked up a X-Men New Teen Titans crossover that was done by Walt Simonson. And I forget who wrote it. Claremont wrote it? Oh, awesome. Yeah. And of course, this is one of those books that if I could go back, I'd say, George, I want you to draw this for me. Simonson did a fantastic job on it. Don't get me wrong. And this was at the height. People don't realize New Teen Titans was selling and rivaling X-Men in terms of popularity, which is why they put these two together. The most interesting thing I found, and excuse me here while I fire up the old Cray 3000 here, I found a DC comic that was published, I believe, in the 70s here, Laurel and Hardy, a one-shot. And excuse me while I get the write-up here.
While you whip this out.
Whoa! And this is always, of course, to my go-to site, atomicavenue.com. And let's see, find it. And you just type in. They don't have a dummy search engine, so for me, I got to make sure I type out Laurel and Hardy. But this was one of those books I wasn't even aware of. Came out in 72. It's a DC Latter Day. They say one of the rarest, but there were plenty of them on eBay, and I just had seen this one. It was a version of Laurel and Hardy that was not based on the original black and white comedy films, but the more cartoony versions owned by Bozo the Clown Larry Harmon and animated by Hanna-Barbera. Only one issue was released. Apparently, the front cover of a second issue exists featuring the boys encountering a Man of Steel, but just kind of one of those weird things. It was just a one-shot, 20-cent price tag. I got a pretty good price on it. I'd say this one's probably very good, fine, maybe at a probably closer to very good than anything. So just a little fun piece of history that that's one of the reasons I love going to this show. I was able to go. My hip was feeling good. A lot of old-timers there. The stories I heard, I should have just notated them down, you know, talking about Hotel Leamington, first Comic-Con, buying comics from different people. I was able to finish my run of Secret Society of Supervillains, because who knew it ended at issue 15? I thought it ended at issue 14. So just a lot of fun, a lot of cheap comics, some good expensive comics, a few artists, but people were in a buy-in mood. You know, it was Sub-Zero Con, which was ironic because it was only a mere 10 above. It had been Sub-Zero overnight, but it was one of those days, you know, as Minnesotans and Chicagoans know, when it's sunny outside, you get in your car, and oh man, you feel like falling asleep because the sun's just heating up your car, and then you step outside, and winter just slaps you across the chops real fast. So that was fun. Going back to work now, I don't get to do a lot of Comic Cons because they're always on Saturday or Sunday, and I work weekends. I will be at the 2-day show. I will be doing the charity booth. So time of year, as you're doing your spring cleaning and you think you've got some stuff you want to donate, either contact me ahead of time or figure out a way to mail it to me if you're out of state, or just bring it to the con and we'll take care of it, because 100% the proceeds go to charity. I know this year it'll be going to Comic Book Legal Defense Fund and the Heroes Initiative, and I haven't talked to the guys. I got to get a hold of them, see who the third charity is. So that's it for me. Anything you geeking on, Mr. Angel?
Geeking on? No.
The whole show has been kind of fun, just talking and stories and things like that.
That was the whole thing. Is I just wanted, I'm geeking off of this stuff right now, so it's hard for me to try to wrap my mind around anything else right now.
Well, we'll throw it over to Mr. Strode. What are you geeking on?
First episode of Star Trek Discovery second season came out. And the Discovery is now being helmed by Captain Pike.
Oh, sure, ruin it for me. Spoilers! Anyway, what were we talking about? We just talked about... Holy cow! I can't go on anything without anybody...
I was in all the ads.
Next thing you're going to tell me, Doctor, who's a woman? Holy crap!
I was in all the ads, Joe.
Oh, but,
the thing I liked about it was people were talking about the first season was very dark and didn't really feel like Star Trek. But the thing that I like about this is they had a plan. So you've got these people who've been through the Klingon War with a captain they found out something dark and terrible about. And now they have Captain Pike, who, you know, let's face it, Captain Pike, he's one of the good guys. And they don't know how to handle it because, you know, they're suffering from PTSD going through all the stuff they went through last season. So I absolutely loved it. It was a great first episode. And one of the things about the show, it is beautiful to look at. It is the best looking Star Trek TV show ever. I cannot get over. They're using high def perfectly. The special effects are amazing. It's just a beautiful show to look at. The second thing I am geeking on is
I just want to toss something in there about the Star Trek, because I did jump on a board where they were talking about how the difference between last season Dark and this season Dark. And I commented it was very ironic, because I'm watching Deep Space Nine, and I just came through quite possibly two of the dark, actually three of the darker episodes. If I get them right, I think one of them is Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night. And we're talking, we're in the, I think sixth season, and it's where Kira goes back in time, discovers more about her mom, that she was a collaborator. She hates collaborators. There was the Inquisition, where we discover the I think it was Section 13, kind of the Tel Shiar and the bad guys of the Federation, and how aghast everybody was. And of course, I remember watching it going, I can see them doing that. And of course, the big one that everybody, let me see if I get the episode right, In the Pale Moonlight, where Sisko tricks the Romulans into joining the Klingons and Federation against the Dominion. Quite possibly the most incredible dark episode of Star Trek ever. You know, that was one thing about Deep Space Nine, and they constantly talk about it in the notes. Oh, people are complaining, it wasn't Star Trek. It was not Star Trek. And I'm like, now to hear you talk about Discovery, I'm just dying to see that first season.
Yeah.
And then it makes me sad that they didn't really get into, well, maybe Enterprise when they get into the Romulan War. You know, in the Pale Moonlight, the big thing they talked about was trying to get it to, it wasn't just a clean starship blowing up. And you know, yeah, sure, a whole, you know, we 1,000 people died, but it was clean. You know, in Pale Moonlight, they talk about the guys looking at the casualty list, seeing, oh my God, there's a name in it, there's people we know, and just pushing Sisko to the breaking point. So anyway, that's just, it was just ironic that everybody's, oh, it was so dark. And I'm like, did nobody watch Deep Space Nine? Anyway,
there is only one comic I am geeking on, Joe.
Captain Marvel number one?
No.
I just bought it, so I don't know what I'm talking about.
The stuff from Box Day a couple of weeks ago. Do you know what book showed up in my Box Day that you have been telling me to read for, I don't know, 9 years?
Oh.
Weapon Brown.
Weapon Brown. Weapon Brown is about a boy named Chuck and his dog Snoopy, post-apocalypse. And it looks like this was done as an online comic that then was collected into a graphic novel. It's, you didn't tell me it was so big. Damn, oh, this thing, it's an omnibus.
It's great. And the best part is the more you know about comic strips, the more fun it is, because almost every comic strip you can imagine, if it doesn't make a cameo, it features in there somehow.
But this is a fantastic book. Oh. And he says in it that he's doing a sequel.
I know. I'm trying, look, you got me drooling again.
So that's the only book I've had time to read over the weekend. It was the best weekend for football. It was the division championships, and both games came down to the wire. And I know that most of our don't watch a lot of football, but we're getting near the end of the season, and this is my first year watching football in, I'm not going to say how long. And I had a lot of fun this year. What was that, Angel?
I said the same for Rob. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. I
watched that game, and it's been years since I watched, so I'm not up on all the rules. But it's like, well, that was pass interference, and no one did anything. Well, believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for over an hour and a half.
Cool.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Joe?
Well, I'm just going to mention, actually, throw it to me last, because I got some music.
Oh, well, Angel, anything to say as we close out the show?
Not really. I had a blast talking about George Perez, and it got me into such a kick that I think I'm going to probably spend the next week revisiting all these old comics that I haven't looked up. Primarily at the front will be the Avengers, the Fantastic Four, and my number one thing that I want to look at right now is that Marvel 2-in-1 stuff. And then maybe some of the DC stuff later, but that's where I'm at right now. And this to me is this is all just staying right now in my head. This is the first time I've actually gotten to talk to anyone about in a while. So that's where my mindset is wrapped around right now.
And one of the cool things about that Marvel 2-in-1 run, that was one of Marvel's first trade paperbacks.
Oh, was it?
Yep. Early 80s, they put out a trade paperback of the Iron Man is an Alcoholic run. They put out a trade paperback of the Dark Phoenix saga, and then the next one they did was Project Pegasus. Because I remember buying that trade paperback going, oh, I wish they would put all comics out like this. And it wasn't just George Perez. John Byrne drew some of that run as well.
Oh, yes. Actually, he drew the beginning start, the start of that series, and introduced Goliath changed over to Giant Man in the best costume that Bill Foster ever had as in his tenure as a superhero, I think.
Now, I'm also going to throw out one thing. It's an Ask Angel.
Does he get a dime?
He, if you get this right, you'll get a shiny new dime. Now, someone inking George Perez was almost as good as George Perez, and he worked on this run of books. Angel Medina, for a shiny new dime, like Uncle Lair would give little Tommy, who was that inker?
He was the best inker that inked Perez, and that's all you're going to give me?
That's all. He inked him on Marvel 2-in-1.
Oh, Marvel 2-in-1. Oh, Gene Day, of course.
That's right, Gene Day.
Woohoo!
Yes, the best inking. Actually, Gene Day, my two favorite Gene Day ink jobs are the Marvel 2-in-1. And then he did that, I think it was like one or two issues of The Avengers where he inked over John Byrne, where they decided the new roster and everything. Man, that was some of Gene Day's best stuff outside of the Master of Kung Fu stuff, man. His best stuff ever.
Gene Day was so
good.
He's
the guy who died of a heart attack, right?
Yeah. Really young. Really, really young, too.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was a big scandal because there were people who said that Marvel worked him to death.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember being in a donut shop at like 1 in the morning with two of my best friends at the time, who were also huge comic book nerds. And we got into a very lengthy discussion about that because all three of us were trying to break into the business at that time. And I remember thinking, like, I don't want to die that young, but if I die, I wanted to be behind the drawing table.
And now you probably aren't thinking that anymore.
By the way, quick little aside. That does remind me. You know Mike Baron, of course, of Nexus fame.
Yes.
And Punisher and all that other stuff.
Yeah, I know Mike. I've chatted with him quite a few times.
Right. Well, someone a couple of months ago, I remember someone jokingly, I think he fell asleep at his table at a convention or something.
Yes.
Where he dozed off. And I guess he didn't know they were taking a picture. Someone said he came by and took a picture of him, dozed off at his table. And I added the comment on there that that's how I want to die, doing what I love.
Joe?
The last couple weeks, we've been featuring a Star Trek tribute band, 5-Year Mission, and they have an event coming up at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, Star Trek Exploring New Worlds. It's coming up fast, and the boys will be playing there 11:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m., so get a chance to head out there. If you can't make it, you can always catch up with them on Facebook under 5-Year Mission or go to their website, 5yearmission.net, and you can see the boys, get an inkling of what they do. Off their fourth album, I've got, let's see, Corey, let's see if you can catch, I will give you a quote and see if you can Cass or Angel, guess which Star Trek episode. It's the original series. The guys make songs that are based on the series. So I'll read this quote and you see if you can catch it. And it's not Space Hippie, so don't worry about it. Yeah. I believe you. Eagle unto Legan to be life for a stand, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Yep, I'm talking the Omega Glory. Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why they don't allow Pledge Allegiance in schools if we can all do it like Cloud William and Captain Kirk. Corey, hit my music.